Okay. So, the reason I'm talking about this subject is because I had the most unusual and wonderful experience of being asked to be part of a very august group of people asked to come to help Shanghai do its planning for a new urban city center and city that is about the size of San Francisco. So you can imagine from coming from the San Francisco Bay Area to be invited to join a group of people that might actually plan from scratch what San Francisco should look like if it had been planned in this age and in this time with this technology, that this would be a really wonderful experience. So this area I'll talk about a little bit more, but I'll give you a little bit of background in innovation before I talk about how this kind of urban design innovation is going on now in many different parts of the world, but in particular in mainland China, which is a bit of a surprise, you would think. Anyway, it turns out that mega cities, cities that are larger than 10 million people, are actually at a crossroads. There are at least 40 or more of these cities, and there are going to be hundreds of them by 2025. That is an amazing thought, if you think of it. That from now to then, about 21 million people, about the size of New York City, will move from the countryside to the city every year in this period of time. So this is one of the most massive sort driving factors that are happening right now. And we are at a really important crossroads. The crossroads is that urbanization, as it's happening, can be a force for good, because some cities are doing very well. Their gross domestic product for their city is three times as high as small cities. But it could also go the other way. And we have certainly seen that happen in places like Latin America, and in fact in the megacities in India, where instead of positive network effects, there being a big advance to having all these people together and being able to work together and have the synergies of all the industries and companies working together, as you might have in a city like Hong Kong, instead, in a city like Calcutta, you have many slums. You have a number of places where there is not enough service, social services, to help people who have come to the city. So instead of them actually advancing and progressing and have a better life in coming to the city, they actually drag down the gross domestic product. They actually drag down the entire city's productivity by congestion, by traffic, by many things that actually are the negative kind of network effects of having many, many people in the same area. So in some cities, the density has been extremely negative. And in some cities, the density and the ecosystem has been extremely positive. And so we have an example of kind of a crossroads of positive network effects for some cities and negative network effects for others. So one of the things that urban planners and governments all over the world are doing is trying to come up with a set of best practices so that as these mega cities appear, that they can probably try to do something that, as this ad from IBM says, cities cannot simply work harder, they must work smarter. So we have to make our cities intelligent so that they actually can help the people that are coming to the cities do better, be more productive, live a happier life, but at the same time be more productive, rather than this negative network effect. Now, what has been found in all of the work that's been done on smart cities is that there are six main dimensions or axes which work together to produce this kind of holistic positive synergy. So if you can get a city to actually use its data, create a technology, often through telecommunications and through the networks that some of you are working on. You can have smart people, because many people will want to come into that city and there will be access to learning in those cities. Smart governance, in other words, having the government be able to interact with the citizens and have the citizens actually be able to return information about things like traffic or about, you know, problems in the city that need to be fixed on a real-time basis. Smart mobility, in other words, transportation and infrastructure, is major. It's so critical, because many of the problems of the major cities of the world are because they were built before there was an understanding of how to get from one place to another. So the fact of, you know, something taking an hour to get to or to transport rather than 15 minutes is a major drag on the productivity of a city. Smart environment. We all know that actually cities can be the most effective environmental area. Because it's high density, in some ways you can do much more for economies of scale for environmental things than you can in other things. Smart living. Big cities can be very livable. Probably all the reason that you're here in a city rather than living in a countryside or in somewhere that more rural is because there is so much to do here. There's work, there's play, there's entertainment, there's a lot of things going for cities. So, my agenda today and why I call this Creativity Inc. is to just tell you that the new area that lots of the hot spot for digital goods and industry right now is in the film and movie area. Digital goods for entertainment. Just like games have been a big thing, now the next big thing is putting all that together for films and entertainment. So I'm going to compare some of the best practices at Creativity Inc. That is actually the way that that Ed Catmull, who was one of the founders of Pixar, called the Pixar campus. He called it Creativity Inc. in a wonderful book that, if you have a chance to read, is fascinating about how he and his co-founders created the Pixar kind of business model that has been so successful. I'm going to compare that with the newly designed Oriental DreamWorks. Jeff Katzenberg has decided to move and triple or quadruple or maybe even 10 times multiply the size of his DreamWorks campus in Glendale, California, near Hollywood, and bring that to the Shanghai waterfront. So this is just announced in the last couple of months in April, and it will be built by 2017. And I'll explain why that's going on and why that kind of innovation is happening now. And I'm going to talk to you about the group and the media project that I ended up having a chance to work on. It's called the DHive Media City, and it is in the western part of Shanghai. So I'll talk a little bit about how Shanghai is becoming, like Hong Kong with the Pearl River Delta, a mega or meta city. In other words, a city that combines the positive aspects of many different cities together by connecting them with high-speed transportation. So what Songjiang is one of the districts of Shanghai that in the past, in the western side, was not well connected. They're now building 3 or 4 new highways plus a high-speed rail system so that people will be able to get from downtown to Songjiang and be able to live in that area and work in that area much more effectively. So it could perhaps be seen as a bit of a model for what the Pearl River Delta might look like as soon as Hong Kong can get connected to the mainland and to all of these cities on the just on the tip of China. I'm going to explain why this is happening now and why the next generation, the millennials, are, for example, in Silicon Valley, leaving Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley is dated. It's the old business model for innovation. They're leaving the suburban sprawl. They're leaving Googleplexes en masse. And they're moving to Twitter and to all of these Dropbox, all of these places in San Francisco rather than in the Valley. And in fact, I realized that maybe only a few years ago when I would have a number of clients come from Europe and from China coming to visit Silicon Valley. And I would be taking them to see venture capitalists. Maybe they have a group that they want to get funded, or they want to test a startup or an idea that they had in the Valley. And I was discovering I couldn't bring them to Silicon Valley, because often enough the partners that a Telefonica had, or that any of the large companies coming to do this would have, were no longer in Silicon Valley. I would say, oh well, I mean, we can go there to visit, just so you can see where Apple is and where Googleplex is. But for our work, for the people that we need to see, the venture capitalists and the partners that you need for your mobile business, they're all in San Francisco. So we might as well spend most of our week in San Francisco and maybe just go down for a trip just for sightseeing, as if we were going to see the former glory of Silicon Valley, because now everything had moved to San Francisco. And so this whole move to a very, very high density but very active kind of network and ecosystem in cities and in these mega regions, meta cities, is the wave of the future. And Asia is definitely going, and Hong Kong is definitely going to be in the very front of that, just because these are cities that have already dealt with a number of the issues of high population and density and making that work in an ecosystem.
Is land price a problem?
This is perhaps an issue. It does turn out that land price is not as much an issue in these new kind of greenfield developments, because many of these, and you'll see, and that's a great question, because many of these are going to create new city centers. So the reason that you end up with more difficulty and more congestion in a city like Hong Kong is because everyone comes to the downtown from elsewhere, in some sense. So it's hard to get from Happy Valley to the downtown or something like that. While as what you'll see when I talk some more about this is that actually, if you were to create little city centers that were much more kind of targeted, like if you had a little, just like in San Francisco, we have a Mission Bay area that is for biotech, and we have an area that's like media south of Market. Well, each of these areas, if they were larger and they were actually a center of themselves, so like little clusters of little downtown areas where you could live and work close to where you were, you would have a lot easier time creating the kind of energy that actually Silicon Valley had when it was much smaller. So we'll see that.
I don't quite still get it, because one of the drives because of this young professional is like...
We'll look at it a little bit. So I just wanted to show some fun pictures of Pixar Studios in Emeryville. Emeryville is a little industrial sort of city zone that's just very close to Oakland and across the bay from San Francisco. And so Pixar, they said, we want to kind of stay within the sort of urban setting that they were in, that was kind of old brick buildings, large, former industrial buildings. So they actually built in the same style this brick building, large campus, as you can see, very industrial sort of chic kind of stuff. So that's Creativity Inc., the Pixar Studios. Now, Pixar. Why are we looking at Pixar as a possible model? what is Steve Jobs'? Was it Steve Jobs that had a secret recipe, or was it all magic? What I'd like to point out that in some ways, what he did was realize the importance of moving to digital animation. That animation as a digital good was much, much more monetizable and usable in a network, and I'll show you why, than films in general. And so if you were to look at these numbers here, I don't know if you can see them, if they're large enough to see, but now in the film industry, box office income is a small part of the revenue stream. It's just a very small part. So now, you know, to say something's a box office success, no big deal in some ways. Because what really makes the difference is the DVD sales, the book sales, the video game sales, and what's biggest for Star Wars, which is this example comes from. Can you imagine that? That number is real. That's not millions. That's trillions, right? $12 trillion in toys from Star Wars licensing. So the licensing of those digital goods and those characters are huge. Totally different than what you would think. So for example, you know, Pixar made the movie Cars. Has anyone seen Cars? Some people have, but not everyone, right? So it was a box office failure. It was a flop in the sense of a box office. But do you know how much that box office flop made in licensing revenue? $10 billion. That's not bad, is it? That's a multiplier of what it made in the box office. Okay, so that's all possible because...
Sorry, Amy.
Yes.
Just go back.
Uh-huh.
I think it's 12 billion. 27 billion. It's not trillion.
Did I turn back?
12.
Did I get that wrong? Let me see. Trillion backspace.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. 10 billion. 27 billion.
Billion.
12 billion. And 27 billion.
Yes.
You're right.
Trillion.
Yes, I was like, oh no, that's true. That would be our debt. We could then purchase a Star Wars to clear the U.S. debt.
That's right. Exactly.
That would be nice. That's what we should have done, rather than allow Pixar to buy them. So, in this case, actually, Cars, Disney's Pixar, made about the same as Star Wars.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's actually 10 billion and 12 billion.
Look, yeah,
too many zeros.
I don't mind even if it's just billion.
Too many zeros for me. Okay, well, how is this actually working? And that's why we're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to do a little aside before we talk some more about that. Innovation. Okay, what do people think about when they see the word innovation? What do you think? Innovation, what do you think of? Paul, help me out. Innovation. New.
Yeah, new.
New.
Different.
Different.
Better.
Better.
Evolution.
Evolution. Yeah. Others. Thoughts.
Other people cannot think of. You're the first one to think of it.
No. Oh, okay. You're the novel. You're the first one to think of it.
Yeah.
So we have, all of us, this is good, all of us have these positive thoughts about innovation, right? The problem is, what this page says, is when you have that positive innovation, sometimes it destroys somebody else's pie, right? Because that new, in with the new, but out with the old, right? So that's the danger.
I'm telling my son, I'm dying. I die so that there are more food for you.
That's very kind of you to sacrifice yourself for your family. So, in some sense, what we see is that in magazines like when Skype came out, this was the magazine cover of The Economist. The internet killed the phone business. So destruction, innovation by Skype killed the telco business. Is that true? Was it, Is it true that the telephone business or the smartphone business is struggling?
It will be, maybe.
But in that case, this was before, you know, you remember when Skype first came out, it's because we thought it was all a zero-sum game, right? Zero-sum means there's one pie. If the new comes in and takes over, then the old has to give up something, right? Because it's only one pie. There's winners, and then for winners to get money, the losers have to lose, right? But I guess what we ended up seeing was after Skype, we had Apple, the smartphone, and apps, right? Now, what's interesting about apps as an invention? Was that a win-lose situation? Was that a zero-sum game? No. It created this huge new market, didn't it? Billions of dollars, right? And where did a lot of those billions of dollars go to? Did they go to Apple or did they go to developers?
Telco as well.
Telcos and developers, right? So you actually included a huge number of people that had not been part of that ecosystem, and you gave them a whole new way to make money from building apps in their garage. And for some of those apps, like Angry Birds, they became businesses, or some that didn't become businesses, like Flappy Bird. Still, that was a positive sum game, what we call a positive sum game, because it expanded the pie enormously and allowed more people to come in, gain something from the pie, but also Apple gained, telcos gained, lots of other things happened. So it made the whole market larger rather than just splitting the existing pie. Right?
And Alibaba games.
And Alibaba as well. So now we have this new view of innovation because of what happened. Digital goods, right? The internet killed the phone business. That was a win-lose situation. With apps, we have a positive sum game. And part of that is because the web has changed the economics of business and collaboration. So that what these Nobel Prize winners in economics of 2009 were really talking about was that you had to do something inside a company. Their whole idea of transaction costs was that transaction costs are so high that to be able to coordinate a business, you have to actually create an umbrella that's a company. So that people can exchange ideas and whatnot, because if you just did it in the marketplace, the invisible hand, you wouldn't be able to coordinate effectively things like technology and innovation. But what we discover is that now with the internet and with communications abilities, with social networking, with all of the ways we can communicate, all of a sudden, we can do some of the very same things that we used to have to do inside a company virtually, right? We can actually create these networks that are much larger than a single company and use the resources and skills and talents and combine and collaborate together to make something much bigger. Because that, in some ways, is what Apple is. They created the platform, but they had to have these hundreds and thousands of developers to be able to make the apps, to make the App Store interesting and something that we would use, right? Same thing with Android, same thing with all a number of different platforms that are being created, right? Even Google, if you think of it, is a platform that can only offer you a good search result because you click and tell them which keyword is interesting to you. So they actually are no more than a voting machine, right? Every click you make is like a vote that they collect and they use to figure out what the next person who asks for that information is looking for, Okay? So even Google is a platform that is benefiting from the collective action of all of us. Right? So, this is all about bits, atoms to bits, networks and ecosystems, and the value of creativity and design. So it turns out that someone like Apple makes a huge amount for putting together, for coming up with the user experience and coming up with the design of the iPhone. And what they do is everybody else that they orchestrate gets a very small part of the puzzle or of the pie. However, I think that's changing. How many of you have used or thought about getting Xiaomi? You've got one. Anyone else? Does it work in Hong Kong?
Of course.
Oh, okay. So what do you think? Do you think Xiaomi is just a copycat? What do you think?
Well, some of it. I mean, Android phones, to a great extent, is a copycat. Xiaomi is the technology is available from the same sources. So Apple and Xiaomi is similar. Of course, the casing, the design, and the software is different.
I would say, I mean, I'm a firm believer that Xiaomi is an innovator. It's just a different kind of innovator than Steve Jobs and Apple. I mean, and it's one that many in the Western world do not appreciate, because in some sense it's a very, very Asian sort of accelerated design innovation. What Xiaomi does, actually, that makes it so popular and why its market share to a large extent has passed already Apple's in China, is because they actually listen to their customers. I mean, in the States, everyone says, oh, Steve Jobs is so wonderful. He kind of comes up with the vision, everyone follows it, and then it will sell because he's the visionary, the single individual who can make this happen. What the founder of Xiaomi did is say, well, I don't agree that has to be the only way that you innovate. I think innovation can happen by listening collectively to lots of people, to see that these features are ones that the Asian and the Chinese market want and that may not work in the Western world. And to think about the buying behavior and what people like in Asia. So, for example, the two things that struck me were that he crowdsources. If some group wants a certain feature, he'll make a phone that has all the features that group wants and sell it. And if it sells, in some ways, he'll offer it to everyone. So he kind of beta tests accelerated design on the fly. Then he also does these flash kind of sales where everybody, he knows who his influencers are. And he'll let them know that he's coming out with a new model or a new type, and that it'll only be available, like, you know, at this time frame. He'll sell out an entire specialized model in less than 1 minute. That's amazing. I think that's innovative. I think that's incredible. I mean, if you could figure out for any of your businesses how to figure out what your customer want and provide it quickly, accelerated design, and you could sell what you wanted to sell by offering it to the influencers who actually said this was what they wanted, and sell it in less than 30, you know, less than a minute, I consider you a hero, right? Anyone would in any area. But instead, we all sort of have these long faces and go, yeah, but maybe he's too much like Apple. That's okay. I mean, in the smartphone area, all of them look pretty much the same. It's the features that make the difference, right? So that would be my guess or thought. And under design innovation matrix, What's interesting, in the design world, you really have two axes. Most of us are in the product or the technology world, right? But actually in the design world, which user experience is part of, which Xiaomi and smartphones are part of, there's another axis. There's technology on one side, but there's meaning on the other. What is meaning? Meaning is what the product, service, or item, or object means. How it is interpreted in the eyes of the user, right? But that's something that's very, very culturally sensitive. You know, the meaning of a Xiaomi, phone is different in its design and its features than a Western phone. So my thinking is that there's a whole aspect of innovation, this design innovation, that sometimes we lose sight of because we are more focused on the technology, on the technology breakthrough or disruption. While as with the, I mean, there's design innovation in lamps. They don't use any different technology, but all of us can tell when something has an amazing design characteristic and is just, you know, something that everyone will buy, and something that's just a me too, right? So there's a whole other area that we don't think about. So what did Pixar do? Pixar was the first 100% digital animation blockbuster. And why is that critical? Because digital animation superstars have the highest revenue licensing fees and revenues. So Pixar has a whole portfolio of superstars, right? Do they ever have to continue to pay these superstars the high price, amounts that Angelina Jolie or that any of the top actors get? No. Once they've created the character, that character earns for them licensings in toys, in DVDs, in all of this. They're a revenue generator, not a cost. Right?
Do the designer get anything?
The designers get paid, right? It's like IP in this case. So yes, they are like scientists who work for a corporation or for a university.
Yeah,
and
they should work for Hong Kong U.
Yes.
We pay them if they invent anything. If
right.
We pay them whatever our income, 1/2 goes to them.
Oh, that's not bad. I mean, in the university, you may realize, you know, you create these patents and they go to the university, and the advantage is that they will create the patent and pay for the patent for you. But what you give up, what the good thing is that because you've done it with university money, you get 1/3 of the licensing fees, at least in the States, and 2/3 go to the university, but then pay, I guess, in like Stanford, 1/3 goes to your department. I don't know if that's the case at
yeah,
the university.
Well, 1/3 goes to your lab.
Your lab. Oh, okay.
That's the reason why we say 2/3 goes to you, because you say how the other 1/3 should be used.
Oh, you see, that's not true in the States. In the States, most of the universities will end up saying your department or school gets it. So if you're in engineering, all of engineering gets, you know, funded by all of the patents that are made. So that's actually a better deal because it at least is more directed.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this is one of the big issues. So what's going on right now is a huge battle is storming. Pixar Disney versus DreamWorks in China. So we have the two characters, Woody and Buzz Lightyear, are going to fight against Kung Fu Panda. So this is the fight of the century. And why is it the fight of the century? Because of Transformers. Do any of you know, have any of you seen Transformers? Yeah? I thought that was great, but it was really hilarious. Beautiful scenes of Hong Kong and of Asia. Transformers is the first movie released by the Hollywood studios that opened first in China. And it grossed $317 million in 31 days by opening in China first. And
that's just box office.
That's box office. That's not anything else. That's box office. So this is maybe a third of what they believe they're going to get long term from that. And it doesn't actually include the advertising revenue they made from all these funny product placements that they came up with that were really hilarious. So there's that, plus IMAX has a big deal now with, and I don't know if it's, I put down the right name, one of the largest China media companies. And it may not be exactly China Media. I had forgotten the name. I put that down. But IMAX, there's going to be IMAX all over China, all over, because this is huge. So Oriental DreamWorks in Shanghai, in Glendale, it's like this little, you know, kind of almost resort-like place with just a bit like Lucasfilm's Skywalker Ranch is a bit like that, you know, just beautiful buildings, a swimming pool, you know, a lake here and that. It's going to be on the wharf. It's going to be $2.4 billion, 40 acres on the wharf, and have like 8 shopping centers and so on and so forth. So a pretty big deal. I was not involved with the Oriental DreamWorks, but I was involved with the and then many of you may have seen Singapore Inc. and Shuian Real Estate made the, oh, I spelled that wrong, Xintiandi, should be X-I-N-T-I-A-N-D-I, Shanghai. I have a typo there. So this whole concept that the new way of going is old and new, reinterpret to a cultural setting, that doing that well can make something modern design cool, win awards, draw top-end retailers, and actually gross the highest square footage for this area that for retail that they've seen. So can one do something like that? That was our idea for Hollywood Reinterpreted for Shanghai. So we knew that, you know, that the DreamWorks was going to go in Shanghai. But we thought, if we have this whole new set of transportation between Shanghai Central and Songjiang, we might be able to create an area in the west part of Shanghai that actually will be even more attractive, because it'll be easier to buy housing, it'll be easier to create a mixed-use area where you can live and work in the same area in a similar way to Emeryville, where it's not very expensive to live in the area, lots and lots of live-work lofts, so that a number of the people at Pixar and the other places that are in that area live right in the area. So we use some of the Hollywood icons and this idea of open innovation. And you can see here that there are like 7 districts of Shanghai, and Songjiang is this area that's on the western side. Okay? What I think most people don't know, but I discovered, is that this whole move we talked about is that millennials actually don't want to be like the people on the right, the car and the suburban sort of house, the ranch style house, that Silicon Valley is suburban sprawl. We would never do that again. They would actually prefer all of these things on the left. San Francisco, huge renovated, you know, sort of industrialized buildings, as you see there. That one I think is Twitter's headquarters in the city with a cable car. And the reason is because even in Googleplex, I don't know if you've ever visited, it is terrible to get around, because they now have like 10 different buildings and they're not close enough that you can get to. I mean, they think it's great to have these little scooters, but I find you can't really use scooters to get to like the campus on one side. You end up going, walking all the way to your car, then you drive all the way to the next campus, and then you have to drive to another campus for lunch. It's actually environmentally unsound. I mean, because to actually get business done, if you're not on the phone, You actually have to go to all these different buildings because they're in different groups. So it actually, having density makes a big difference, is positive for environmental, because you can do, you can scale things, you can make things work within a building that you can't when you're spread out too widely. And so actually Silicon Valley and suburban sprawl is completely wrong for environmental sort of the wave of the future. So, you know, Asian cities have a chance to do it right, actually. So you may not realize, but Songjiang actually is, they found an archaeology that's the cradle of civilization. 6,000 years ago, they found for archaeological findings. And when they did that at the same time, they discovered that it actually was the starting location of Shanghai. And you go, why could that be? You know, it's so far west of the river. But it turns out that 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, the river actually was in a different place. It was more west, and so they were closest to the river at that time, and over time it retreated. So actually it was the starting location of Shanghai. And so they decided to actually, Shanghai decided to put a huge cultural park in Songjiang to show some of the things that have been the start of civilization for Shanghai. And so that's, it's kind of cool to have this cultural park and city right next to the area that's going to be the most modern sort of Hollywood area. So what we proposed was art plus design plus technology in a livable space. So global digital media hub, a technology district, and a town center, all in a small close area. So it would be very livable and very, very easy to create the positive synergies and ecosystem. We said that we would try, we had each member of the team actually cover one of these areas. So we had the person who designed all of the environment and parks for New York City's High Line was part of the team. The person who did all of the transportation was the person who was in charge of all of transportation for San Francisco and had created the Mission Bay. The smart environment, we had Arup, the engineering firm, send a number of their people. On the smart economy, I got to do the smart economy part, on the industrial sort of target. So we kind of created in the people who arrived to do this team a sort of our own little ecosystem that represented knowledge bases from all over the world and all over these different six areas. And we created the D-Hive, where people connect. And so some of the things we did was, you know, try to figure out what to do. And now we get to see the video, I think will be the easiest. Can we do the video at this point? How do I do that? Just go to escape here and... I have pretty pictures of all of them, but this is kind of fun because this is just a 3D view, fly through of what it's going to look like. Is it working now?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, there it is. Okay. Cool. So part of what you'll see, it looks like it's in this rounded circle. It's actually the shape of the ancient city of Songjiang, which was in a walled city. And so we use some of the same areas to in the new city in some ways.
What is the D stand for D-Hive?
Digital media hub in some ways, the D-Hive. And also to say it's like the beehive, it's sort of a very much a integrated, active energetic area. Lots of kind of spaces to sit and talk. Part of this is to think, as you look through it, it's to think that Hollywood, as it is now, is actually a whole place where business is transacted in sort of little restaurants, in parks, in lots of different areas. Many of the people who work in the film and the creative industries are freelancers. So that you end up with a script writer meeting with the producer in a little cafe and talking it over. You find that the producer, you know, is meeting with the people he needs to get to do the materials or the screenshot in another location. And so this whole idea that transaction costs have been reduced, so a lot of this digital stuff can go on just, you know, through wirelessly, but that the real work of creativity still needs in some ways to have people meet together and be energized by brainstorming and meeting in different locations and to create an environment for the kind of creative people that where that is really important.
Are they supposed to be living nearby?
They are. That's the whole... Oh, that was the whole thing. I didn't point this out, is that this is an entire mixed-use campus, so that some of these buildings are buildings for, you know, with health clubs on the top and living quarters for people. Some of the buildings are retail outlet on the bottom and different restaurants and whatnot, all recreating in some ways a space that is like a campus, but is an entire mini city in its breadth of buildings and types. And then the building types were drawn from a number of the sort of the colors. This one is all in white, but a number of the colors and the buildings and the iconic buildings are drawn from sort of media kind of areas.
How big is it behind compared to the Bay Area?
Oh, okay. Digital hub? Okay, this one is actually one of the first that was approved by the Shanghai Planning Committee, so I was allowed to show this one. But actually, I know that they're considering the actual plan for Songjiang is actually going to be about the size of San Francisco. So there'll be everything from you know, sort of a fashion design center, a retail area, to a Internet of Things area, to a, you know, so there'll be all of these new kinds of areas that they're just planning out right now, and there's this huge master plan that actually covers really a size of...
So that's only a block.
This is only one of the blocks, but I had asked before, I asked what I was allowed to show, and this one had already been approved and had already gone through the committee, so they said I could show this one, but that the other ones were still in process. But as a result, my understanding is that this one will actually be built by, in 1 year's time, probably a year, from now, and that the other ones will be built by like 2 years' time. So it's really amazing when you can work on Greenfield. It is like one of these, you know, video games like Sim Tower or Sim City that you create, you know, sort of by scratch and then it appears. Well, we've already seen this happen in some of the Greenfield areas in China, which is that you go there and there's fields, and then the next time you go, there's two highways, and then the next time you go, there's, you know, there's X number of buildings, and then, you know, this is so different than other places like India.
So what kind of industry they probably invite in this first phase of the...
In the first phase, it actually is they've already had a joint venture, a partnership with a Singaporean creative media and digital design animation group.
So and so DreamWorks isn't there?
DreamWorks is not. This one is not DreamWorks. DreamWorks is actually in Shanghai. They took a different approach, which is they said, okay, we're going to go right in the center of the city in this one new area, that one area that's the last area of the waterfront. And we're going to build this like retail outlet, this kind of stuff. And they can do that because they had, I guess, a very good agreement with also with the government in terms of having the IMAX studios and the retail and that whatnot. What's interesting about the Saint-Jean, I think, city is that this is more of a greenfield effort. This is an area that has light industry, has mostly rice fields and things like that, and yet is actually right now, if they had a connection with downtown, could be 15 to 20 minutes from downtown with high speed. But they're creating all of this because they believe that once this is there, then a number of the creative talent that will be needed to work in the city for DreamWorks and these animation houses and design houses in this area will want to live in this Saint-Jean area, which is going to be much, much more affordable and have its own little city center, so that if they don't need to go in to downtown except for meetings, they can do most of their work and their kind of creative job in this sort of Hollywood-like, you know, area that has you know, lots of restaurants and places to visit and really attracts almost the creative freelance type millennial that is needed for this sort of industry to really get its traction. So I just wanted to end up with mentioning that part of why I decided to talk about this here is because I was so inspired when I worked there that this is such a big possibility. Hong Kong is one of the places that is known for its media, its design, its energy in this area, and art. And so I just wondered if there was any effort or whether there was any work being done on the cultural industry side, creative industry side, to kind of have Hong Kong be the leader in this possible mega meta city that will exist due to the Pearl River Delta kind of transportation area.
It's very interesting. Very difficult because we spend all our energy arguing.
Oh.
The West Kowloon projects, for example, became an instrument for political struggle and argument, and it took so long, and it's not there yet. So our competitiveness is actually fading away very, very quickly.
Right.
That concept for Hong Kong, Dong Chi Hua actually had that with Cyberport, but we kind of mess it up in terms of scale, and also there were a lot of controversy when it came. That's the reason why I asked whether people live there, because traditionally our concept is residential. This is a residential area. This is an industrial area.
Right.
So you're supposed to be separated.
Right.
Now you integrate everything.
Yeah. It is really more of a new concept that is just a number of these urban designers are starting to work on, just that they're believing not only for environmental, but also for livability, that it makes more sense, and for the interests and needs of this kind of new millennial population that would rather be close to work and their friends and their mostly younger, single, not as many families, that this works better for attracting that new group of talent that's necessary to make these things work. So that's just wanted to end up, if there's any questions, I hope that you've gotten some idea of some of the practices at Creativity Inc., some of the things that are happening with Oriental DreamWorks in Shanghai and DHive. Just to tell you this funny thing that millennials are leaving Silicon Valley behind. Silicon Valley is dated, outdated now. It's all San Francisco.
Yes.
You know, we were the baby boomers. That's all over. now it's happening in San Francisco. And then just to show this 3D video walkthrough of at least one area that is going to be built shortly, and that soon an area almost the size of San Francisco will appear right next to Shanghai and be connected to it with highways and with high speed.
This is really exciting. At least the positive message I have is I have always been complaining the campus at Hong Kong View is not very good, not like the others with trees and roads and greens. Now I feel that we are actually ahead of time. We are a little bit like San Francisco in that I can go to all the departments within Hong Kong View without driving and walk there comfortably. And of course, all the buildings are high rise and you have to wait for lifts, but you have to do that in San Francisco too. Any question for Amy?